of the Mud Puppy Games Network.
I'm John Peterson of Playing at the World, and you are listening to Save for Half.
Welcome to the Save for Half podcast, where we'll talk about old school games and the modern games inspired by them.
Talk, everybody. Welcome to the Safer App Podcast, a podcast about old school games and the modern games inspired by them. And today we're covering a modern game, a game called The Dareluck Club, written by Lou Hofer and published by Dandelion Games. I am DM Mike, one of your hosts, and I will be playing the role of Sam Emerson from The Lost Boys. What are you, the flying nun? DM Liz is here and will be playing Sarah Anderson, the little girl with the Thor fetish from Adventures in Babysitting.
I wouldn't call it a fetish.
An obsession?
She's highly admiring.
And DM Corbett is here as Lawrence Chunk Chone from The Goonies.
Totally doing the truffle shuffle.
And finally, DM Jim, last but not least, as Gordon Gordy LaChance from the movie Stand By Me.
Because there was nothing else to do where I grew up in Kentucky except get out on the railroad trestle like idiots.
Yeah, I was about to say, that was probably a movie that stuck with you because, well, it kind of hit close to home. And we're talking about a game called The Dareluck Club, a game about things that are stranger than you might think.
I see what you did there.
I get it.
And the crowd goes mild.
don't quit your day job.
Man. It's kind of a role-playing game of kids dealing with strange things, whether it's supernatural or science fiction. Or a dead body, right, Jim?
Yeah, we're going to talk about that because it's this. I think this game is its own thing, but it's interesting what it's adjacent to.
Yeah, it's kind of like D&D will handle all sorts of fantasy potentially, and Traveler for any science fiction potentially. This is that sort of movie story book thing that involves basically a bunch of kids as protagonists. And so we will just jump right into that. But first, a podcast from our sponsors. Hashtag not a sponsor.
Into a world without nearly enough quality gamer podcasts, they came. The Grognard Files, a podcast about role-playing games from back in the day. You know they're experts because they speak with British accents. Find them at armchairadventureblog.com, iTunes, or wherever fine podcasts are served.
Broadcasting from the back of a van.
What have we gotten into?
It's Radio Free Muncie. Three dudes talking about gaming and comics.
We're going to have some old school versus new school discussion.
All through the lens of the Knights of the Dinner Table comic strips.
Lair of the Gazebo classic strip.
So join us at anchor.fm/Radio Free Muncie.
He's here! My mystery dude! Day.
Mystery Day. Are you ready for your Mystery Day? Don't be late. It would be great. Open the door for your Mystery Day.
Mystery Date, the thrilling new Milton Bradley game of romance and mystery that's just for you. And you, and you, and you. Mystery Date, will you be ready for swimming or a dance? When you open the door, will your Mystery Date be a dream or a dud?
Oh!
Fun and surprises, that's Mystery Date. Remember, Milton Bradley makes the best games in the world. So, girls,
open the door for your Mystery Date.
Get Mystery Date.
This portion of the show is being brought to you by Frozen Power. Yes, with Frozen Power, you don't need warm water to clean your laundry. You don't even need cold water. Just mix your laundry load with half a cup of Frozen Power's frozen cleaning crystals, stuff it all into your freezer, and the next morning your clothes will be clean and crisp, really crisp. And you can throw away your clunky old dryer because with Frozen Power, you never dry, you thaw.
It's time for Mike and the Mechanics. Sorry. That's Mike and the Mechanics of the game. My bad.
And Mike and the Mechanics. Thought you got away from it, didn't you?
I'm counting on it this time because I did not understand these rules all the way.
I had to get Liz to describe them to me because partially because the font. But I'll talk about the font later. Suffice it to say that even in a PDF, my conversion, I understood every third word, maybe.
Ooh.
Because it came out really bad, and even trying to correct it, I only got 90% of the words corrected.
I'm going to blow one of my own top fives before we even start. At least it wasn't Comic Sans.
There is that.
There is that.
It was a cousin. But
yeah. I still give it 1,000 bonus XP layout points for no Comic Sans.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Anyway, the RPG has, like many RPGs, a set of attributes. 7 of them, to be precise. 5, and then the last 2 are combinations of some of the prior ones.
Yeah, I got some Champions vibes from that.
Yeah. Mm. The attributes are Scrap, Spry, Pluck, Brains, Shenanigans, and rather than straight numbers, you have 10 dice that you can deploy to each of them. You could give each one 2 dice if you want to be boring. What kind of dice? How does this work? Well, something, and everyone correct me if I misunderstand this, but you start with a dice pool called a toy box. And in the dice pool, you can choose either 1d10, 2d8, 8d6, or d4, 5. And I should say probably more like these are times you can use them.
Yeah, it's like a dice selection pool, if that makes it any clearer.
You could choose d10 once. So if you've, say, got 2 dice in brains and you decide you really need to make it, you can spend that once, and for that attribute check, you roll 2d10. Because you have 2 dice in it. And once you run out all of it, you then can grab, or it resets itself. But you have to use up all the dice in those number of times. Also, that's how you start out. As you kind of go up in level, or as they call it here, goob, your dice pool expands. Now, those remaining 2 attributes, one is called oomph, and that's your scrap plus spry plus pluck times 2. And your marbles are your brains plus shenanigans plus pluck times 2 to end up with the numbers for that. You also can choose things either called niftiness, which are kind of advantages. They cost 1 of your dice. And you can get disadvantages called mischiefs, which gain you a die. But when you have a mischief, you gain a die, but then you get a +5 on difficulty involving that mischief. Because like a lot of games, you're rolling to try to reach a target number. And without hopefully killing everyone else's top fives, I've told you how to do character generation. Everything is an attribute check for a target number. And so we will go into first impressions.
It's just a first impression. I could be totally wrong. It's only a first impression. And though the impression is strong, it never can hurt to question.
First impressions. Jim.
My first impression is you just took my whole top five, so I'm going to sign off now. No, I'm kidding. I kid. It's as much credit to Liz and Corbett as it is to Lou. This is another instance of we rotate turns picking these games, and I'm just like, you know, I'm busy guy. Okay, I'll read this, you know, where I never normally otherwise would, because it's just not close enough to my interest. And now I've gone and ordered a copy on Amazon. I love this game. I love what it does. You know, I have a game designer's appreciation for Kids on Bikes and Tales from the Loop, but given a choice between those two and this, I'm playing this. I'm really intrigued by Lou's game engine choices that I, as we record this, don't even fully understand. But the creative oomph and the dice marbles he gave us to play with are just fascinating to me. Plus, I'm in a target audience, so I love this game.
Okay. Corbett.
I think I was thrown as far as like the initial kind of jump into it. I was expecting it to be, I don't know, more like a kid's adventure, and it's sort of like an adult's version of a kid's adventure, which sounds okay.
I know
really
exactly
gross,
what you mean.
Weird.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Okay. So it's good. It's good. Overall, experience-wise, reading, it's really fun. A lot of like little tidbits and things to get like, oh yeah, I know what that is. Oh yeah. So thumbs up so far? Let's start with thumbs up. Good.
Okay. Liz.
Okay. Well, disclaimer, this one was my pick. I wanted to do this one. So I read through. Naturally, you know, I thought of the fairly obvious comparison to shows like Stranger Things. I also thought of some of the cartoons I watched as a kid. Some of you listening may remember, it didn't last for terribly long, but there was a Hanna-Barbera cartoon called Clue Club. And I thought of Clue Club a lot when I was reading. But I also thought a lot, and I mostly thought a lot about some of my favorite books growing up, especially Daniel Pinkwater. If anybody read Lizard Music.
Huh.
The Snark Out Boys and the Avocado of Death, Alan Mendelsohn, The Boy from Mars. I got so many Pinkwater vibes from this game. I mean, when I was a kid, I desperately wanted to live in the world created by Pinkwater's books. And I think you could easily recreate that kind of setting with Derelict Club if that kind of campaign is your jam. Also, if it is, contact me because I want to play in your game. But yeah, Pinkwater. I think you could do a Pinkwater type world with this game so easily.
I hadn't even thought of that, but you're totally right. Especially Snark Out Boys.
Yes.
Okay, my first impression. I see where everybody's coming from, especially Corbett and Liz, because it's certainly got a lot of flexibility to it, I think. And yet, it strikes me as probably more complex than a kid would be happy with. That being said, I was a 12-year-old who played AD&D.
Right.
Maybe I'm selling kids short here.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that really bugged me about some of the basic expert sets that came out after I started with Holmes was that I felt like the language was dumbed down so much. It's like, eh, I don't want that. I want the big words. I want all the stuff.
Well, yeah. Similar to how I feel at my age now, I don't think I entirely understand the game engine, but all I'd need to do is sit down and play and have somebody run me through it, which is how most of us learn to play AD&D. You just sat at the table, they handed you a sheet, told you what dice to roll, and a couple of weeks later, you got the hang of it.
Yeah. You know, talking about complexity, when we were in Luau Lu's It Bites B-Movie Monsters game at North Texas. It was basically a card game, so I couldn't play, but I sat up there with Liz for a little while and just listened and paid attention. The rules for that originally struck me as excessively complex. But I'd say by half an hour, everybody was just snap, 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 following the rules, drop in their cards, like it was no problem.
I can tell you what he did and why I love it so much is because I could tell from reading it, he took a game engine design approach of let's strip this thing, this engine apart and all the way down and then rebuild it and see how much of the chrome we really need. So it seems complex because it's not D20 based, but I bet it's not really once you get playing it and get an intuitive sense of how it all rolls.
And I'm grumpy he didn't put D12s in, except in extreme circumstances.
Oh, well.
Grump, grump.
Well, hey, if once you manage to graduate to the hunky-dory level of toy box, you start getting D12s to use.
That's why I was saying extreme circumstances. So, you know, grump, grump.
I hear he's working on a second edition, Mike, so just give him what you just said as the pull quote for the back cover.
Grump, grump.
Great game, except no D12s. Mike's no day.
We want D12s.
D12s. Too much is never enough. All right. Well then, in that case, let's hit our top fives.
The Save for Half Top 5. In 5, 4, 3, 2.
And now we'll start with Liz.
Alrighty then. So one of the things that, I mean, I loved a lot about this game. I'm going to try and not just be gushy-gushy about it. But one of the things that I liked is talking about the stats for your characters. As the rules go into it, they aren't necessarily based on the reality of what the kids are really like. At least in part, your stats are partially based on what the kids think they are.
Oh, right.
Yeah, you could conceivably have 3 dice in, say, brains. You're trying to think about this logically, thinking, what 12-year-old is going to have 3 dice in brains? Because, you know, that's more like an adult sort of thing. The kid themselves and their friend, well, she's a genius. I mean, she can do all these classes and she's always making A's and the teacher's always saying how smart she is. And so the brain stat partially reflects that. And I think that is a pretty neat riff on the universal game idea of codifying character abilities. It's not just cut and dried what is, but it's also what you think you are and how you see yourself.
Watch out for that kid. His dad sent him to karate classes.
That's right. He will kick your butt.
Rules lawyers need not apply. Okay. Corbett.
Ah, good. I was hoping you'd pick me. I have a follow-up. Because as you know, there were no ladders in the listing.
Are you sure?
I checked. But naturally, I got to waste time looking up what the value of stuff is and why it works that way. And I found it really interesting because most things are on a sliding scale. Like, oh, you get a bike, but it's 300 versus 1200 or whatever. Like, that could be any kind of value because it's just when you're getting your knickknacks. Now, what do they call them? Swag.
Swag.
Swag. Yeah.
When you're getting your swag, your stuff, you have a value to it. And I was kind of like trying to see, like, okay, what are these points worth in real money? And the one thing I could determine for sure is duct tape. He has 1 price point for duct tape, which is 15 value, which of course I found out some fun, interesting facts about duct tape by researching online for an hour and a half. But from original duct tape, which is $7.50, to nuclear grade duct tape, which is $60 a roll.
Mythbusters level duct tape.
You never know.
But an average roll of duct tape is $7.50, which means that basically a roll of duct tape is, or a value point is worth 50 cents. None of that averages out in everything. And that's when I kind of came to the same realization that Liz pointed out with the way that the attributes work. It's the same way that the value of everything is, because like beer was, what was it? It's $250 for beer. But as a kid, it's impossible to get. So what value would you give it?
Yeah. But the thing is, swag value. The ratings are based on the value of a collectible or a baseball card. So, you know, which I also liked, you know,
it's a barter system almost.
Yeah, it's not dollars, but, well, a kid is going to think, well, if I wanted this really badly, I'd be willing to trade 15 baseball cards for it, you know,
right,
or something
right.
Like that.
There's what it costs in a store, and then there's what it costs when you're meeting up in the middle of the woods.
Right.
And that only makes sense because, I mean, while the movies and stories and stuff tend to emphasize the 1980s in the appendix end, it covers everything from the 60s to today. So,
oh yeah,
you don't want to put a flat dollar amount on anything.
But it just reemphasizes what Liz was saying, that they kind of made it what the value of the thing is the thing that you think the value is.
Mm. Yeah.
To a kid.
This is the value because I believe it's the value.
And also, no ladders. Mm-hmm.
And what kid's going to buy a ladder? He's going to steal it.
I know. But rope for sure. Rope is in there. I was okay with that.
Okay. Jim?
My goodness, Corbett. So now it's the ladder or the duct tape. Every game. My number five is the kid stats. And it kind of follows along on what Liz was talking about too, but more from a game designer, game engine point of view. I really thought, because I'm talking about the parts I could understand, the action resolution and when the dice go up and down, I'm a little shady on, but I did figure out that the primary stats, like you talked about in Mike and the Mechanic, scrap, spry, pluck, and brains, they're like your main stats that you decided which dice went. Then the next stats are all derived stats, shenanigans, and then oomph, which is kind of your hit points, and marbles, which is like a junior high school version of sanity check, are all derived. And they're not just normal, like in a D20 game, like we're used to. It's those stats together are sort of both a sophisticated hybrid action resolution system and a skill system all at the same time. And I thought that was just some really nice game design.
Okay. My five. He has an appendix N, and he calls it an appendix N, which I thought was really cool. I wish I could have done that in Victorious, but I got yelled at for that. It's not sequential. Anyway.
Oh, because there was no A through M?
Yeah, pretty much. I only had like two other appendices, but it's like, but who cares?
Have the rest of them appendix or appendices C through.
Although,
like C appendix N.
I don't want to tell you how you design your games, Mike, but I went with appendix M for MCC, so maybe you should have done appendix V.
Appendix V. Oh, that's true. Although they would have yelled even more at me for that one.
Probably.
Yeah, maybe.
But anyway, although I gotta say, you know, you had stuff like Adventures of Babysitting, Goonies, Flight of the Navigator, It? Children of the Corn?
Hey, there was a group of kids who was an integral part of what happened in It.
Children of the Corn, though.
No. I was surprised there wasn't Red Dawn, because they were kids.
Or Children of the Damned.
Yeah.
Last Starfighter was there, but Back to the Future wasn't.
Yeah, well, you can only fit so much on a page.
Right, that's kind of what I'm thinking of, and like Liz pointed out to me.
What was that one Next Generation episode where they got transported into kids?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Put that in there.
Well, like Liz pointed out to me, you know, it's like he's saying what influenced him, not necessarily trying to comprehensive. And that's true. If he tried to really become comprehensive, good Lord, he could probably do as many as I did in Victorious. Anyway,
which is,
that's mine.
I think is fair in that it's a very stretchy system. You could, if you decided to, run those scenarios.
Oh, yeah. But I don't know that I'd want to run Children of the Corn. Or, you know, it's like, gee.
Well, but say you were running a Victorious game and you had a villain who had a ray that turned heroes into children
and ate them? What?
Story happens.
Well, let's put it in your wheelhouse. Say it's a Morrow Project set of cryotubes opens up and it's just kids. What the hell do they do now?
Yeah.
No, that wouldn't work. Sorry. That was a bad idea.
Well, and, you know, but bringing up Victorious, though, I mean, Victorious has whether grand or grim adventures, so I suppose you could say the same here. If you wanted to do something kind of darkish, you could.
And let's face it, Stranger Things gets pretty darn dark for kids to have to deal with.
Especially last season, yeah. But anyway, that's mine. Four, Liz.
Okay, number four. When you're making up your character, there is a section on your character sheet called Making a Contribution. This gives the players an opportunity to help build the shared game world in some way. You have places to put down your favorite place, someone they love, not necessarily romantic love, but someone who's important to them, someone they hate, an urban
like
legend, an urban legend or something that they know about, something that they want to find, and some kind of trouble that the town is having. The Grand Poobah is not obligated to use all of these contributions that are provided by the players, but they can take the ones they like, and it helps to keep them from having to do all of the creative world-building work themselves, especially the things, you know, people who are important to the players, characters, people, rivals, or people that the characters hate. I mean, that's a great way for a Grand Poobah to insert those NPCs into the campaign and, well, I'm going to make some trouble to this character here, so here's their rival showing up and doing something, things like that. I liked the ability for the players to be able to inject some stuff into the game world, and I also like the fact that the Grand Poobah doesn't have to use it all. They can take what piques their interest. Mm-hmm. It's like, huh. You know, I like the concept of this pizza parlor that this person put down as a hangout. I'm going to use that.
You know, Liz, it sounds like you like saying the word Grand Poobah a little too much.
I do. Poobah. I could say poobah all day long. It's almost like saying smuck.
Monkey.
That's another fun word.
Okay, Corbett.
Okay. Actually, a tiny note on Liz's thing was I did think it's funny that there was a list for people I hate. I just immediately saw that when I was looking at the character sheet. Like, wow, okay, let's go that route.
Why did you list all the members of your club as
people who have wronged me?
Those stuck-up future farmers of America.
Yeah. They'll pay.
I hate those guys.
Something I really liked was, well, a couple of things. I mean, there's a lot of stuff to like in this. Honestly, you know what? I'm going to endorse Jim's endorsement of buying the book. How about that?
Yeah.
This was actually something I pointed out to myself because I kept like, I'm reading it as a PDF because we got a PDF for it. I'm sorry. It's difficult for Mike, but it has a lot of like, it's like it's handwritten. Everything has jotted notes and everything all around it. But it kept driving me nuts because I keep reaching up and trying to scratch off like, oh, I got a thing on my screen. No, it's on there. And it was driving me nuts.
And Corbett, there's like 50 corny, terrible ways to do a spiral notebook spread layout, right? And and Lou somehow did it in a way where even some of the illustrations look like they were hand sketched into the notebook, you know, when you're bored in class, and some of them are just professionally designed graphics dropped down on the page, and it all works somehow.
Oh, and I'll tell you one thing, if you buy the actual book on like the first I won't say anymore, but there's something really cool and Jim's going to talk about it.
Well, graphic design wise, I'll leave that to you guys. But just in general, like I would endorse buying the book because it drove me kind of crazy because I kept thinking like, oh, there's something on my screen every time I'd scroll up a page. And it was fine. Great job on the layout, but it was just like too good.
Okay.
There we go.
Right. Jim?
Okay.
Better mention it now. So.
Yeah. I'm going to go now.
Do it now.
I used up a chunk of it already just commenting on Corbett's comment. I love the layout. I'm sorry that your reader, Mike, struggled with it. He must have gotten you a manuscript or something because I can tell you know more about it than I do. I love the layout and design. The body copy and header fonts, Liz, I liked. I mean, I might have done something different with the header fonts, but that body copy I actually liked, not just because it wasn't Comic Sans, and I didn't recognize the font, but he picked a good one. I thought it was very legible to my old tired nearsighted eyes.
It's easier for me on the PDF screen than it is in the physical book, because I do have a physical book as well as the PDF.
Oh.
Wow.
Your mileage may vary.
We'll find out when my print copy shows up. But once I noticed it, I went to all the trouble of fussing with my PDF reader so that I got the two-page spread and then started hammering the down button like crazy on the pages you were talking about, because it's so much like a school notebook. There's a little flip animation down in the corner right hand of the right facing pages of a monster with crab claws wandering onto the page, and a little tank rolls up and shoots him. And that just hits me in the feels, because my favorite day in school was when I had like the 10 cents to go to the student bookstore and buy a brand new fresh notebook, because I went through them like tap water because I never paid attention to class. I was the kid back there drawing shit and doing little flip animations like that and making my own comic books. Love it.
Cool.
That is awesome.
Okay. My four, I know this bugs some gamers, and I kind of see where they're coming from in some games. But I really think his use of terminology in this game really helps get you in the mindset. You don't have a game master, you have a grand poobah. It's not a party, it's a club, etc., etc. Various the nifties and the attribute names and some of the Flummoxburg that they're in, you know?
Oh, that is the best town name.
Yeah, I really think that's... In this sort of game, I think that's important in order to get you in the mindset. And if you don't want to be in the mindset, why are you playing this game?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's my four. Liz, three.
Okay, number three. Mike talked about in the mechanics part about how you've got niftiness and mischief, or advantages and disadvantages, if that's easier terminology for you to keep track of. But one of the niftiness abilities that you can purchase for your character when you're creating it is something called the montage. And I think this is pretty cool.
We need a montage.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Once per adventure, you can call for a montage in order to skip dealing in-game with a long series of actions. And you can achieve the goal with a guaranteed result of 18. So it kind of, it allows you to, like, otherwise you'd be spending hours, you know, it's like, oh, we need to build this elaborate mousetrap to do the thing. It's like, well, let's just do the montage and skip over that and assume that we finished it, you know?
Just end with a high five.
Right.
And all
works. You know, it's like, and the thing is, it's got to be something that's not critical to the story. So you couldn't use the montage to ensure success in a final showdown. But if it's something like building the contraption, or we're going to go around town and question people to find out something, you know, it's
we
like,
need
well,
to
instead
rebuild
of,
the frat house. Yeah.
You know, let's, instead of spending a bunch of game time going through the motions, it's like, okay, I'm using montage and we succeed and we're done. Let's go. You know?
Okay, Corbett?
I can follow up with time. I really like the way time was metered and measured in the game. It's set by about five different types. Beats is like combat round. You know that each turn, everybody gets a turn, just like normal. Then moments are sort of event scenes. So, I don't know, somebody gets a cool Christmas present and they show it off. I'm like, oh, it's a neat scene. Then you have your encounters, which... I was a little hazy on at first, because I think what they're kind of talking about is like, oh, we're going to go to Old Man Scoville's house. And like, oh, well, there's the part where we have to run away from the dog in the backyard. And then there's a part where we break into the attic on the attic floor. And then we wind up in the basement. So it's like three or four moments inside the encounter, from what I kind of gathered. And then, of course, you have days, which are days in game play, and adventures, which breaks down the entire thing. So the idea is, if you have a niftiness that you can play like once per adventure, that covers the entire scope of the adventure and not the days. Anyway, it's kind of mundane, but I think it's a really nice breakdown. I was one of my, I think, frustrations with D&D was always that, like, it was very confusing about combat rounds versus
round turn segment. Yeah.
Yeah. They would break it. It didn't make a lot of sense to me the way it was explained, I guess, or the way I caught it. I kind of got it from everybody playing and like, oh, okay, this is what we're doing now. But I like the way they explained it out, and they kind of set it to motion. Anyway.
Okay. Jim?
I really should be taking notes this whole time of how to make the perfect RPG for Corbett.
Oh my gosh. It'd be an RPG for
well,
insane
rumor
people,
has
so.
It. We're recording this, so, you know. If true.
Oh, that's right.
Include ladders.
I'm so busted. I want to reinforce something you talked about, Mike, because one of the things I really enjoyed in this game was not just the overall creativity and quality of writing that went into it, but Lou's aptness for naming things. You like you just mentioned. I mean, it extends to the illustrations and some of the, I don't want to call them props, but virtual props in the game. Like, you know, okay, I want to have a pizza parlor or a brand name, and he just renames it like those wacky package stickers we used to have. He's really good at that, but it goes into the rules too. And this game has a dice pool like other games do. And jump in if I got the mechanics wrong, but it's a set of 4 through 20 minus the D12 of dice that you keep in a pool that you can, a couple, three times a game, you can just yank one and add it to one of your abilities for a check, an action check, right?
The number of times it says you can use it. Yeah, like D4, right. I think, is 5 times.
Yeah, there's also some niftiness types that give you a separate pool, and you can add dice from that pool to a regular roll. So you've got the two different things.
Okay. Well, I mean the one called a toy box. Every game could have, lots of games have dice pools. In this game, it's called a toy box. And the second I read that and got my head wrapped around it, I'm like, these 3D sculptors love to make dice trays, especially for DCC and some of those games where there's a giant dice change just to keep your dice organized. I would never, ever use one of those. I don't care. But this game cries out for a talented 3D sculptor to make a printable toy box shaped dice tray for it.
Yeah,
I'm too busy to do it. Jolly Blackburn's too busy to do it. Tom Tullis is too busy to do it. Somebody listening to this who's a talented 3D sculptor, get on it, because this game needs a 3D printable toy box dice pool tray.
Your mission, should you choose to accept it.
I'll buy one.
Pretty much. Okay. Well, like Liz was talking about one of the nifties, what I really liked, and I'm not sure how I would steal it for Victorious, but I would like to because I like the concept, called That's Not How I Remember This. Remember
it. Oh, yeah.
And it actually gives you the ability to more or less replay a scene or a moment, I guess it is. And that way, if it went off the rails or something, you're just like, no, it was like this, and you get to basically do it over again. And I think that's cool, as long as it's a non-combat thing. I think that's a nifty idea, especially if you're dealing with more of a literary type game.
Yeah, it kind of allows you to have a mulligan. It's like,
yeah.
Like, wait a minute, this turned out really badly. That's not how I remember this happening.
Actually, I came in and this happened, yeah. So I thought that was cool.
Let's replay this.
Do you have to do it right after the event, or can you do it at any point?
It says you can force a replay from a turning point of your choosing, but not beyond the beginning of the current encounter.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that kind of stuff in this game. This is not a game for hard-bitten war gamers to get down and try and jack and power game the rules. This is for having fun.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. And some of these niftiness abilities, if you're used to, say, playing a superhero game, you know, some of it's kind of like Heroes. There's an ability called Pack Rat where you can make a shenanigans roll to try and find something useful on your person. And I've kind of got a character in Victorious named Chance who has the ability to alter reality. And he can use his luck powers to see, does he just happen to find the thing that he needs for this particular thing that's going on?
You know how they say, like, so-and-so's a beer and pretzels game? This is like, it's a Mountain Dew and Doritos game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, Liz, two.
So there is a section of notable items that can be dropped into the campaign world. One of the ones that I particularly liked was the Polybius arcade machine. And it's an arcade machine which mysteriously appears in a local arcade as a free demo. And at first blush, it looks like a spaceship simulator game. But there are weird video bursts that seemingly randomly inject into the game, unreadable text. The description goes on to say, they say that kids that play this game too long walk off in a strange stupor. The next thing you know, they're attacking their parents, setting fires to public buildings, or disappearing altogether. Before the game is shut down and shipped off, a crew of men dressed in suits always come in to download data off the motherboard. So it's like, I really like that. And you could do all kinds of stepping off of adventures based on this machine just suddenly appearing in your arcade.
Because video games rot your brain.
Yeah, and it's a free demo, so you don't have to use any of your quarters to play it. Naturally, you're going to try it out.
Oh, heck yeah.
And it's more what I was talking about, too, because the illustration for it is awesome. And that name, Polybus, it just, you look at it and you go, oh, yeah, that was in the arcade in the 80s. No, wait, it wasn't.
But it should have been.
You've been chosen by the Star League to defend the galaxy against Zur and the Codan Armada.
Or it's downloading blueprints for how to build your own junkyard spaceship like an explorer's.
Oh, that too. Mm-hmm. That too. Okay. Corbett?
The rule for the cooperative role I thought was really nicely laid out. It's designed so you can basically, like, oh, say you have three dice and the person who's going to help has two dice and you roll three dice and you get a one, a two, and an eight, and they roll a four and a six. Then you can swap out your lower dice with their upper dice and they help out really simply. It moves really quick and easy. I kind of like that. The only thing I didn't like about that was that he suggests at one point that too many chefs will mess up the casserole, which I thought was a funny saying. He never really goes into the explanation of what happens when the third guy goes, oh, well, I'll add my dice. Is there a point where it's too many people trying to grab a hold of the steering wheel where it goes off the rails? And it's I've run into that in Star Trek a lot. We're like, I'll scan. No, me, I'll scan.
I scan
suddenly
first.
Everybody on the whole bridge is scanning. Anyway.
Yeah, that's.
I was agreeing with you, Corbett. That happened to be one of mine, but I got a bunch. What's the normal thing? You just one main guy rolls a d20, and then everybody who's helping adds their ability modifier. Well, I'm kind of bored of that now. So I thought his solution of swapping the dice in and out was cool, and it works with this game engine really well.
Oh yeah.
Okay, Jim.
It's a very clever fit.
My number two is that this game's target audience is not the one I expected. And Corbett covered this a little bit in his talk with Lou last episode. You look at it, you just like rifle through the pages, go, oh, this would be a great game for my kids. No, it's not for your kids. It's for you, Mr. Boomer. Okay, Boomer, you know, Gen X to Gen Z. This is a game for you to go do a role play, a fantasy version of your childhood. And I thought that's really interesting because a lot of us do that unconsciously or unintentionally. I do it. I write old school style games because I'm an old school gamer. But Lou, I thought it was kind of genius to target this game at the boomers. I mean, could you play with your kids? Sure, but they're going to miss all the 70s and 80s coming of age references, get bored, and you're going to look over, and instead of rolling dice, they're staring at their iPhone.
Yeah. Why can't my character have an iPhone?
Yeah. You know?
Nice design choice. Thanks for writing something for us. How about you, Mike? What's your number two?
My two is, I thought for a back of the book intro adventure, it was fairly involved. That whole, you know, intro thing.
The whole mob thing?
Yeah, the mob thing. And like you mentioned, the video game beforehand. I mean, I know that was separate, but still, you could combine the two. And I had a very Home Alone vibe from that. I'm not sure why, but maybe it's because it was criminals, but
he emulated a lot of classic stuff in there, so it's very possible.
Yeah. All you need is some gremlins.
There's a third-party product right there. Somebody goes stat up.
Goblins.
Wow, I just blanked on his name. Macaulay Culkin. I said it wrong. You know what I mean.
I know
the
you
kid
mean.
That starred in Home Alone.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Liz, number one. Take us home.
Number one. Oh, gosh. So I guess going back, talking about your liking of the mob adventure in the back of the book, one of the things I particularly liked about that starter adventure, there's a portion of the game where the kids are probably going to be going down into sewers beneath the city. And the way he's got the sewers set up in the intro adventure, they are generated randomly rather than you having a static map of the sewer system. You roll a D10 every time you enter an unexplored part of the system, and the result determines the section description, whether it's a straight corridor, a T intersection, whatever. And it kind of helps to build the idea of a weird labyrinth that is just confusing.
Kind of like those tunnels the Goonies were going through.
Right. So I thought that was pretty inspired. The sewers are never going to be the same twice for any particular group playing them. You're going to wind up with a different layout. But yeah, it's always an unexplored part. So once you've explored it, that part is mapped out in stone. You know that part. But I mean, it's anyone's guess what it's going to be like as you go on.
Okay.
Shades of appendix whatever in the Dungeon Master's Guide, where Gary gave you those random tables for doing it with dungeons. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
From Strategic Review. Yeah. Pretty cool. Okay, Corbett.
Okay, in the game you can't, well, you can. I mean, I guess it depends on how you treat it, but you really can't die. Not really. When you run out of, I think it's oomph.
Oomph, yeah.
You know, if you run out of oomph, you basically are kind of dumbfounded, broken leg, whatever. You're basically not a functional character. But you can technically roll to, is it recover? Yeah, you recover oomph with your marbles, right? I forget how that works.
Can Corbett and I do our numbers together? Because that was my number one too.
Oh, I can do another one if you want. I got
no. Let's do it together. Let's okay. Team up like two okay. Kids on our bikes, right?
It's a cooperative. It's a cooperative role. Yes.
So let me chuck a dice in there. So damage equals oomph, I think. And Mike, you correct me if I'm wrong. And you kind of have a sanity check with the marbles.
Yeah. That's why it's based right. predominantly on quote unquote mental as opposed to oomph, which is physical.
So you can run out, I want to say damage. You take oomph loss or marbles loss and you either end up so tired you can't do anything, participate, or crying in a corner losing your marbles, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing that I was going to say, actually, because technically you could still have your own too, because I was just going to mention the strike three you're in rule. Which is an optional rule. It's not actually part of the official rules. But his whole thing is after three times of failing, you're back in regardless.
Yeah, with a quarter of your original points, something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But you're still like, you're not sitting on the side going, I guess I'll just eat these Cheetos and wait until the end of the game.
Which right. again, emphasizes that whole feeling of participation.
Yeah.
In this game, you're not going to really die. Everybody work together and have fun.
No death in the game. And I love the name choices. Like the recovery methods for oomph loss are walking it off, getting first aid, getting professional medical help. If you lose your marbles, you can attempt to recover just by pulling yourself together or getting help from a friend or seeking professional counseling. I don't know if that one would trigger gamers or not, but
take a lap.
And then like, just like Corbett said, you miss the roll three times in a row, you're still back in.
I really like that.
Okay.
I thought it was pretty fun.
Since you two combined that, I'll just go to my number one. Again, and this gets back to my surprise that Back to the Future was not part of Appendix N, because there's something you can get called a hoverboard. Which is a mysterious crate of these things appeared at the landfill. And kids got them and started hovering around on them. And I'm just like, but okay, that screams. Was there something else that had that I don't remember? Because to me, that's Back to the Future. But either way, something utterly awesome for kids to have. So I'm totally on board.
The shenanigans you could get up to with the hoverboard.
Exactly. Yeah, very true. Exactly.
I mean, hoverboards and train track trestles almost go together.
Right.
They totally do.
And the way they describe that Flummoxburg is next to a landfill, that's also kind of an option open to the Grand Poobah to introduce all sorts of weird things into the setting that you want to. Well, it just appeared at the landfill. Yeah.
What's at the landfill today? Oh, it's an iron giant. Holy crap.
Awesome. All righty. Well, then we shall take another pod break. And when we come back, we'll see what makes a save and what...
Hey everyone, this is Tim from Tomorrow's End Podcast. If you're interested in post-apocalyptic Morrow Project, then Tomorrow's End Podcast is for you. You can hear us at tomorrowsend.org, or you can find us on iTunes, Google Play, Facebook, and more.
Here at This Old Dungeon, we know times are tough.
My wife was pregnant with our fifth alpha when they told me they didn't need no Cooper no more at the Shady Dragon Trading Post. I had the basic rule books and only a worn-out copy of B2. I thought the adventures were over for me and my group. Then I discovered This Old Dungeon. Thanks to This Old Dungeon, my group and I are back at Gateby, and those caves are more chaotic than ever.
With all the money I've spent on minis, I don't have the cash for those newfangled 200-page full-color adventures. but thanks to this old dungeon, I've been running my group through the same copy of Against the Giants since 2018. It was easy after listening to them. I just replaced the giants with ogres, then minotaurs, then werebores, then magically enlarged kobolds.
This Old Dungeon is the program where old adventures are made new again. Come listen to hosts Bill, Edwin, and Lou as they reminisce about classic game publications and discuss how to renovate them for an all-new tabletop experience. Catch This Old Dungeon from your podcatcher of choice.
Your attention, please. Kenny G will not be appearing at this year's Kansas City Blues and Jazz Festival. Even though Kenny G was never scheduled to appear at this year's Kansas City Blues and Jazz Festival, we want to make it absolutely clear that Kenny G would not be appearing at the Kansas City Blues and Jazz Festival, even if Kenny G underwrote the entire cost of the event, although he is certainly welcome to do that. Frankly, if every blues and or jazz musician on the face of the earth were to mysteriously vanish, Kenny G would still not be appearing at this year's Kansas City Blues and Jazz Festival. But, you may ask, what if Kenny G were to somehow seize control of the military? Under this scenario, Kenny G would still not appear with Ramsey Lewis, Arturo Sandoval, and nearly 50 other authentic blues and jazz greats at this year's Kansas City Blues and Jazz Festival. Finally, on a personal note, if you are Kenny G, under no circumstance will you be appearing at the 11th Annual Kansas City Blues and Jazz Festival, July 20th through the 22nd at Penn Valley Park. For tickets, call 1-800-530-KCMO.
What makes the save, and what is going to take?
Free art!
What makes the save, and what? Free arcs. And this time we'll start with Jim.
I love this, and I have meant to. What makes the save is I was getting Lou Hofer in stereo this whole week because I'm reading this game for the podcast on the one hand, and Lou has written the adventure that's in the issue of Scientific Barbarian that I'm laying out currently. So I was just drowning in Lou Hofer goodness the whole thing, the whole time. And I've known Lou for a while, but I don't know him as well as I need to. And I think that although this game, I understand this game is gaining a lot of traction, what makes a save is that it's, I think it's criminally underrated for its concept and execution. And that's why I called Lou today and found out that there's a second edition on the way. And I'm just standing, it makes a save because I can't wait to back the Kickstarter for the second edition of this.
Okay.
What doesn't make the save, it's the only big bone I've got to pick. And thanks, Corbett, for calling me out on your interview because you knew this was coming. The reason this game needs to be more popular is so that Lou can make more money selling it and keep designing other cool games so he can afford to hire a copy editor because nobody can copy it himself. And that was taking me out of the game every seven paragraphs. I say that with all the empathy in the world. That's why I said we need to promote this so Lou can sell more games and get more money, because you gotta have a certain print run to be able to afford a copy editor. But, you know.
Right.
My rule is maybe Edgar Allan Poe and Shakespeare didn't need copy editors, but the rest of us, unless you're that level guy, we all need copy editors.
Okay, Corbett?
Makes the save. It actually does achieve the nostalgia feel that I was really looking for. The thing that everybody keeps telling me, you know, like Stranger Things, everybody's like, oh, it's so nostalgic of the 80s and 90s and whatever. And I'll watch it and like, well, they didn't use that kind of phone jack at the time. And this is all kind of, it's like when people show the meme with the Rubik's Cube colored everything. And then they show, you know, this is what everybody thinks the 80s was. And then they show a picture of wood paneling and
orange shag carpet.
Yeah, like, this is what the 80s was.
You're not wrong.
I get the wood paneling and the shag carpet feel out for this game as far as nostalgia feels and everything that a lot of things really don't deliver. So I think he nailed that down. Like, I felt like I was a kid trying to read through somebody else's notes about how to play this game because it had that feel to it.
Okay.
Doesn't make the save, though. It did a great job and had a thorough amount of information in the book, but because of that, it felt kind of long. And I feel like I'm a bad guy saying, like, it's too long, but it's like 200 and something pages.
220 pages, yeah.
Yeah, I was expecting it to be like small. 60 to 100. So, yeah, if you buy it, you're getting it, which is great. I don't like hate anything. There's nothing in there I was like, well, they could throw that away. It was just more of a, like, I felt like I wanted it to be the pamphlet, the brown books. I wanted it to be the brown books. And that sounds weird saying that out loud.
Right. I think that gets back to what Jim was saying, is that initial reaction is this game is a great game for the kids. But then you look at it and it's like, no, this was not made for kids. This was made for adults.
Yeah.
This isn't meddling kids in the RPG. It's more straightforward Gen X, maybe Gen Y, millennials. So maybe boomers, if any of them are still role-playing anymore.
I don't know. Old people role-playing doesn't seem right.
I got news for you, my friend. Our idea of who old people are and someone my nephew's age idea of who old people are entirely different concepts.
Oh, I told Liz, you know, in Traveler, when you start taking major hits at age 55, when we were starting to play, you know, back in the late 70s, early 80s, I'm like, yeah, okay, that's reasonable. That makes perfect sense when you're that old. But now when I'm 54, it's like, that's not old. Wait a minute.
Yeah, well, I and my trick knee are now saying, you know, maybe Traveler had it right after all. I do feel like I'm starting to physically break down.
Yeah, well, my back and yeah, okay, fair enough.
Mike, I saw the Flash movie this week, and Michael Keaton is like Captain America's shield. His body does not obey the laws of physics for someone his age.
Oh, lucky him. All right. Well, Liz?
All righty. What makes the save? I'm trying to figure out how I want to put this to where it makes sense, not just to me, but to other people hearing it. The game, it walks a fine line between reality and possibility. Think like the same way a kid's mind and imagination will color the world around them. Mm-hmm. I think Lou did a fantastic job of capturing the feel of kids on an adventure with things happening that may or may not be bending reality around them. Did some of the things that happened to the kids in the game session actually happen? If so, was it really what the kids thought it was? With that, and with how oomph isn't just straight hit points, it's morale and stuff, and the stats are based on what you think you are rather than just totally on what you really are. The belief in something in a lot of ways throughout the game is more important than what it's supposed to be. And I think that's really the true heart of what being a kid is all about.
Sort of like the movie Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Did all that really happen?
It's like, you know, well, I believe that this is what happened. And so, as far as I'm concerned, this is what happened. This is what happened. You know, and you get that feeling with the rules of the game. What doesn't make the save? I'm going to beat on the font. For the print version, the font used for the body text was terrible for readability. The print version that I have, it was such a thin font. It just sort of melted into the page. It was hard for me to focus on it. I'm usually a big proponent of physical books over digital, but in this one particular instance, I strongly recommend that you get the digital version so you can zoom in on the text and make it easier for yourself. Like I said earlier, I've got both versions. I've got the print, I've got the PDF. I found it easier to read the PDF than I did the print one. And so your mileage may vary.
No, you've got a fair point, because it's that thin font on top of a background art of the lined pages of a notebook.
Yeah, it just sort of kind of bled into nothingness. I had a hard time focusing on the print version of it. For me, that was the worst part. It was a lot easier for me to get through the book once I got the PDF. You know, I could read it a lot easier. Yeah. And these rules are awesome. It's worth reading.
Okay. What makes a save? For me, it's a relatively unique topic and setting. Before this, I think Kids on Bikes came out after this was originally published. But even so, that's like just two games. Beforehand, if you asked me an old school game that this equates to, I couldn't say anything beyond Teenagers from Outer Space. And that was more of an anime RPG, kind of an Urusaya Yatsura with the serial numbers filed off.
Right.
This is allowed, and it has such breadth of coverage. I mean, you could do Stand By Me or The Wonder Years just as easily as you can do The Last Starfighter or...
Children of the Corn.
Children of the Corn.
I mean, you could do Stand By Me. You wouldn't want to, but you could.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, well, at least nothing happens to the kids in there, but, you know. But yeah, and you've got a lot of coverage here. And like Liz said, it's as much the kids' view of an adventure as the reality of an adventure, which again gets into that whole argument Jim and I talk about at times, the simulationist school versus the adventure school, I guess, or more the experience than worried about, does this exactly replicate reality? It's like, he don't care. That's not the point here. Does it make the save? I'll echo Liz. Fonts. I mean, I like the, like much like JV, I like the idea of it being on a spiral notebook and giving that whole nostalgic, this is somebody's from high school or, you know, middle school spiral notebook feel. But as someone trying to read it using, and this is purely on me, but trying to use a OCR conversion to try to read this thing, it came out horribly. There were many times I was trying to read a page and it's like, I'm not grasping what this is saying. Liz, can you tell me what page 78 says in brief? I had to get that kind of help in order to even get the full character generation because it was like, it was so rough for me to read. But if you don't have vision problems, you know, you're not a 54-year-old traveler character who's, you know, taking attribute negs. You're good. You know, you can do this.
Mike, is that why this episode I kept inviting you to correct me on my understanding of the rules and you didn't?
Partially, yeah. I think I've got it, but I wouldn't swear to it. I'm expecting an email from Luau Lu going, how so very dare you, sir? You got all this wrong. And we'll read it or have him on the show to give us a correction if we're way off base here. So we did the best we could with what we got. And remember, it's Liz's fault.
It is my fault. It's all my fault.
All right. Well, this has been the Derelict Club by a guy named Luau Lu, also known as Lou Holder.
You sure you said that right?
Hofer. Sorry, not Holder.
Hofer.
Hofer?
Lou Hofer. Maybe it's a pseudonym.
If it was still the 1970s or 80s, I would have spent long distance money calling them to make sure.
See, kids, there was a time where you had to pay extra money for calling people outside your town, and it was really, really expensive because phone companies stink. And that's just how they are.
And your phone never rang, and it turned out to be a Russian scam artist.
Yes. On the other hand, yeah, you didn't get pummeled with that sort of... Instead, you got chain letters in the mail, and you too could be a winner.
Those were the days.
Those were days. Yes, they were. And I'm going to relax in my beanbag on my orange shag carpet and bid everyone a fond farewell. Say goodnight, everybody.
Good night.
See ya.
Adios.
This isn't how I briark this. And we're out.
You should have montaged that.
I totally should have montaged that.
The Save for Half podcast is a production of the Mud Puppy Games Network and the Gagman Podcast. The Save for Half theme music is provided by the band Mississippi Bones. You can find them at mississippibones.bandcamp.com. All player characters mentioned in this podcast are fictional, and any resemblance to PCs living or dead is purely coincidental. No NPCs were harmed in the making of this podcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Save for Half.